Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And this hour, we will give you some insights into the changing situation in Iraq. We'll remind you of the growing severity of the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. And actor Mark Duplass is the perfect comic relief for all of that. Later this hour, advice for living from the man who made a hit sitcom out of people obsessed with fantasy football. But our attention turns first to the situation in Ferguson, Missouri. More violence last night, 30 arrests. Attorney General Eric Holder is getting personally involved in the investigation into the death of Michael Brown. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called on U.S. authorities to protect and uphold the rights of protesters, as did the government of Egypt today, urging the U.S. to use restraint in dealing with the unrest, echoing language the U.S. government used to warn Cairo during its own political violence more than a year ago. But before we speak to a parent and a school official about the challenges in Ferguson once the schools open, we want to take you right to the street level last night, courtesy of the BBC, who recorded this. Here is a frustrated woman pleading with State Trooper Captain Ron Johnson.
When they started throwing tear gas, I started running. I stayed right there on that renter-owned lot right there. And I blocked myself in by a truck, and I was crowding like this by myself, me and a camera guy. And they continued to throw tear gas around me to where I could not leave. And then when I got up and started running, they was throwing rubber bullets at me, shooting them at me while I was running. He kept going. You could go right over there to the renter owner. I went by today, and all the bullets is in the wall. And I'm a peaceful protester. I've been out here giving out water, chips, and candy, and cookies, and ask people to stay within the lines. Do not disrespect the officers. But when they touch me, that's a problem, because it is people out here that give a care. We care. We stay here. I just moved here 3 months ago from L.A. I ain't lived in St. Louis in 8 years. But that's wrong. It needs to be some control. I want to be a police officer. I went out for LAPD. I wanted to do this. I came home to do it. But to see them do us like that is not right.
An amazing moment, conveying powerlessness, fear, anger, and also showing that people still trust Captain Johnson to make things right. Here's part of Captain Johnson's attempt to reassure the woman and alert her that outside elements, in his view, are infiltrating the peaceful protesters.
You talking about you're crying now? I stood there and cried. I stood there and cried. And then behind the building, guys are coming back there shooting guns. Guys are over here shooting at police officers. I cry. And I tell you it isn't right, because you are out here. But that element is blending in, and the bigger we let the crowd get, it's easier for them to blend in. Did you see all the bricks that were in the center of the road? You know what? Because, when you were walking, you didn't see that. But, you know, as you walk, somebody behind you is putting a brick here, putting a brick there. And that's why we've got to make our community better. And right now, they're taking our right to do that.
A very visual moment from last night in Ferguson, Missouri. Captain Ron Johnson speaking to a citizen on the streets, recorded by the BBC. We turn now to the challenges for teachers and parents who have been dealing with the fact that schools are closed this week. And when they reopen, students, parents, and teachers will have a lot to talk about and maybe even more questions. Dr. Scott Spurgeon is superintendent of the Riverview Gardens School District. Riverview includes the location where Michael Brown was shot. And parent Melissa Fitzgerald has 3 kids in a nearby school district. Fitzgerald organized the Parents for Peace Facebook page to welcome students on their first day back. Superintendent Spurgeon and Melissa Fitzgerald, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Spurgeon, what do you think students are going to be bringing into the classroom, and what do teachers have to be prepared for when the classes finally are in session?
Well, as of right now, we know we actually had class last week, all 5 days, and we actually began those conversations last week with students and with families. So we believe that they're going to be bringing in with them a sense of hurt and a sense of needing some conversation around what they're seeing on TV on a regular basis daily as things continue to escalate in the Ferguson area.
Is this an opportunity to speak about authority and civic awareness and civic involvement and the role of law enforcement in civic life, or is it much more a question of healing and dealing with hurt?
It's actually both of those very issues and topics that you just mentioned, but a part of our character education program, we do deal with the fact of citizenship and how we make good decisions, but it's also helping our community begin the process of healing and moving to a place in which we can continue life in as much in normalcy as possible.
Melissa Fitzgerald, I'm a parent, and my little children, you know, often get really wide-eyed and amazed when they see law enforcement officers with weapons. I suspect that may have turned a little sour in your community as things have gotten much more violent.
Well, and certainly I'm not quite as close to Ground Zero, so I'm able to protect my own children from a lot of that. But certainly what I'm seeing from the members on my Facebook group is that, you know, these are conversations that maybe they didn't have to have with their children before. And, you know, you want your children to respect authority and you want them to feel at peace in their community. And when things like this are happening, it's a challenge to reassure children who don't understand what's going on, that they are safe and that the adults around them will protect them.
Do your children feel safe?
I think my children are confused because we aren't as close to the real significant action that's happening. And I certainly have protected them from seeing that on the news, even as difficult as it's been, because that's all that's on television right now. But I have to tell them why we're not going to school. We were supposed to return to school last Thursday, and we found out last night that we're not returning for the rest of the week. And so I had to explain to them in simple terms. I was able to explain a little bit more to my 10-year-old, kind of broader situation. So I just think they're confused and they're nervous, and they are sorry for what some of the children in the areas that are closer are dealing with.
Melissa Fitzgerald, who is it that your kids point to as having the most credibility in this crisis? President Obama, law enforcement official, the governor, Jay Nixon?
Well, for better or for worse, I would say me. I'm their filter for all of this. And so I haven't allowed them to watch the speeches on television, or because I don't want them to really realize the magnitude of it. It's one thing when you're watching something like that and the president talk about something like that when it's not in your neighborhood, when it's not in your community, when it's not a stone's throw from where you live. And so I don't want them to know all of the powers that are at play here. I just want them to know what I can filter to them that's age appropriate, that will make them feel safe. And quite honestly, that will make them not form opinions one way or another about what's happening, because they don't have that yet. And I really want to protect them from that.
Dr. Spurgeon, who has played the greatest leadership role from the perspective of your students and faculty?
Well, I'm very glad that you asked that question. We were asked to have a conversation with the Missouri Attorney General, Chris Costner, and we also were given the opportunity to visit with Captain Ron Johnson. We met with both of them last Thursday, and that we had about 20 students that came in on Thursday morning prior to the change in strategy for the peaceful protest. And our students felt very proud of the fact that they were able to give each individual some real on-the-ground information about what needed to be done to make some changes to turn the situation around in Ferguson. And we believe that the Attorney General and Captain Johnson have done a great job. My number one person would be Highway Patrolman Ron Johnson, who's on the front lines every day working to develop relationships and keep things at a peaceful state.
Yeah, he's been a pretty amazing character who stepped up here, that's for sure. Dr. Spurgeon, how do you respond to a 10th grader or a 11th grader saying to you, look, I'm scared. I'm scared. I'm a young black male. I'm scared. I don't think I'm safe in this community.
Then we need to talk about what reasons that our 11th grade student is feeling that way. And it's our job as administrators to do whatever we can to ensure that we alleviate or at least keep that to a minimum.
Melissa Fitzgerald, how do you think this will be remembered by your kids 5-10 years from now?
Wow. I think for my 10-year-old, it will be something that he will obviously remember more clearly than the younger two. And I think that what I hope is that what he will remember about this was a turning point for our community, that this was the point where we said, we're going to have tough conversations. There are going to be things that we decide we need to do differently individually, that we decide we need to do differently collectively, and that he is going to be proud of the progress that we've made in our community. That is my hope.
A better racial conversation, Melissa Fitzgerald?
I would say a better racial conversation, a better socioeconomic conversation. We live in a diverse community, and my kids go to school with kids that don't look like them. And that's what we value about our community. That's why we stay. And I want them to understand that with that diversity comes people having different experiences. And we need to recognize that our experiences are different than maybe my neighbor's experiences. And I want them to be part of that conversation of saying, once we recognize that, once we recognize that some of that is not good, that's when we can start changing it. And I hope that in 10 years, there will be enough change that we won't be having the same conversations that we're having today.
Finally, Dr. Spurgeon, it's a sort of bit of educational jargon, but I'm sure people are going to ask you this question. What's the teachable moment, the big idea here?
The teachable moment for us as a school district, not only is the care and the concern and the safety of our children, but to continually evaluate how we respond as a system to the needs of our communities. And it's really about what can we do collectively together? What is our part in ensuring, as what Melissa said earlier, that 5-10 years from now, we're not having these same conversations.
Dr. Scott Spurgeon is superintendent of the Riverview Gardens School District, which includes the location where Michael Brown was shot in Ferguson, Missouri. And Melissa Fitzgerald is a local parent and organizer of Parents for Peace Facebook page. Melissa and Dr. Spurgeon, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
There's one other important issue in Ferguson, Missouri we want to try to assess right now. Last night was the first test of the National Guard presence in the city. Jay Nixon, the Missouri governor, called in the Guard earlier this week. Overnight, there were more than 30 people arrested, including some journalists. Joining us now to help us make that assessment from Ferguson is Tanzina Vega, national reporter covering race and ethnicity for our partner, The New York Times. Tanzina, welcome.
Thanks for having me, John.
Did the presence of the Guard settle things down in Ferguson, or what effect do you think it had?
It had a very limited effect. I mean, they, you know, state and local authorities are still the ones that are sort of on, you know, quote unquote, the front lines here dealing with the protesters. The National Guard was pretty much at a command center and meant to protect that command center, which is a couple of blocks up from where a lot of the, I think all of us have heard about the McDonald's on West Florissant, and that's sort of the main area where a lot of this activity has been happening. And so a couple of blocks up the road from there is a Target, and that in that Target parking lot is where the sort of police command center has been. And so the National Guard was essentially posted there for the evening with orders to sort of stay there and protect that. So we haven't seen much of a direct impact so far.
So it seems, and it may be a smart move here, the National Guard has something of a low profile, and Captain Johnson is trying to maintain a pretty high profile on the streets. Is that what you observed?
That's correct. I actually was there last night, not for the second part of the evening, which devolved into, once again, we saw lots of conflicts and clashes with the police. I was there for the first part of the evening, which was very peaceful and very calm, and folks were holding long-stem roses and chanting and marching very peacefully, and lots of clergy were there. And as I made my way up the avenue, at one point, we saw Captain Johnson coming down and talking to residents and sort of engaging people who had some really pointed questions for him. And he would stop and take those questions, not just from the media, but also from just average everyday folks and passersby who wanted to ask him about everything from their civil liberties and their civil rights to, you know, to why things were evolving the way that they were. So he is, at least in my observation, that in some instances trying to engage directly with the public. And that was what I observed last night.
You know, observing from afar here from New York City, there's sort of two images, and I'm wondering if you could assess, you know, your heart really goes out to the peaceful protesters and their attempt to take back their community. But there's also this quality when the violence occurs, and I don't know if it's the impact of pop culture or what, but the streets of Ferguson sometimes look like this merging of, you know, the video games Grand Theft Auto and Call of Duty. I mean, with the militarization of the cops and the sense of people on the street, I mean, it is a really surreal feeling to see those pictures. I'm wondering if you're getting any of that sense as well.
Absolutely. I had that sense two nights ago when we were, a colleague of mine and I were getting to our position at the media center, which was in a parking lot right next to the McDonald's in front of a market that's sort of been issued for media to be there. And we drove there what we thought was relatively early to make sure that we would be there to report on the curfew, which was still in place at the time. And getting there and seeing, both media and the occasional protester wearing gas masks, and we drove in right at the time when tear gas was being lobbed to protesters, and the scene was very chaotic. There was a helicopter or two flying overhead. It was a very, like you said, surreal scene, and it almost does look like something you just wouldn't imagine that you would see that here. And so being tear gassed and having that experience and seeing the chaos that ensued, there were people who were yelling and saying, look, there are kids here. Like, why are you doing this? It was just a very chaotic moment, and very surprising to witness that.
And you really have to feel as though there are going to be lingering impacts of this as the community begins to deal with its divisions and the various ethnicities. This is a diverse community, and that conversation will be had going forward. Tenzina, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Tenzina Vega is a national reporter covering race and ethnicity for our partner, The New York Times, in Ferguson, Missouri.
Hi, this is Laura Zeman from Troy, Missouri. Because it has a white government and police force, this community has issues. I grew up near Ferguson. It was not like this. We lived harmoniously together. The problem started when your police and firemen don't have to live in the town they work in.
Hi, this is Jason calling from Texas. I think it's partly a media problem and partly a cultural problem. Every news outlet I've heard report on the Ferguson incident stressed that Michael Brown was an unarmed black man shot by a white police officer. But I think that answer belies a cultural problem among both whites and blacks. I'm a white man. Some of my closest black friends were raised, in their own words, to be colorblind, as was I. I'd like to believe that the majority of whites and blacks are this way, but like in so many cases, I think the vocal minorities in both camps who perpetuate racism and segregated thinking seem to have the loudest voices and get the most press.
Some of your contributions to this national conversation. From Lindenhurst, New York, the tribalism that exists within countries is stronger than the national identity when it comes to domestic issues. As a nation, we only come together when our foe is an outsider, and we should just admit that in America, many issues are still, in fact, a matter of race. Are you viewing this situation in Ferguson differently from your neighbors? African Americans have posted, "Why aren't my white friends more outraged about this? Is there a diversity of urgency about the situation in Ferguson and in general the threat to young black males from law enforcement and other aspects of our society?" We are going to tackle that issue head on. Tomorrow we're partnering with our friends at St. Louis Public Radio for an hour-long special on the events in Ferguson and how different people are viewing it differently. We want your voice to be a part of it. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway, and be sure to tune in tomorrow for more. Some apparent good news from Iraq, and the president was quick to jump on it yesterday.
Iraqi and Kurdish forces took a major step forward by recapturing the largest dam in Iraq near the city of Mosul.
Forces of the Islamic State had been in control of that Mosul dam complex for a week, putting a stranglehold on Baghdad and wide areas of central and southern Iraq.
If that dam was breached, it could have proven catastrophic, with floods that would have threatened the lives of thousands of civilians and endanger our embassy compound in Baghdad.
A crisis averted, but it is an unlikely coalition that is fighting ISIS with U.S. assistance around that dam. Iraqi forces recently fighting against the Kurdish Peshmerga army are suddenly on the same side. And there's a third ally, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or the PKK, a group that has been officially designated a terrorist group by the U.S. government, principally because of their bloody campaign against NATO ally Turkey. The PKK joining this coalition truly makes the current conflict regional, with possible implications for Turkey, Syria, and Iran. Aliza Marcus, author of Blood and Belief, The PKK and the Kurdish Fight for Independence, joins me now. Aliza, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
So this is a historic moment, this coalition of Kurdish forces coming together, and it's got to worry some nations that traditionally haven't wanted to see a united Kurdistan armed forces.
That's true. This is really amazing because for the longest time, the PKK, the Turkish Kurdish force, has not only been fighting Turkey, but it's also been an intermittent conflict with the Iraqi Kurds. And what we see now is that when Kurdistan itself is threatened, and there's no question that the fight by these Islamic fighters threatens Kurdistan itself, Kurds come together to defend what they see as their land.
And will that mean that when the smoke clears here, that this coalition will stay together and that a unified Kurdistan will have a chance to become a nation on its own?
Actually, I think the chances of a unified Kurdistan and the coalition staying strong are somewhat low. I don't think that the Kurds see themselves as wanting to or being able to govern together, but they certainly see that they want to support each other's attempts to set up self-rule and to be able to live in this area peacefully.
How will Iraqi Kurds respond to attempts by the PKK to attack Turkish forces in eastern Turkey, where Kurds have traditionally demanded territory?
Well, right now you have to remember that the PKK has a tentative ceasefire with Turkey, and it's been that way for about a year and a half. And Turkey keeps saying that it's planning some sort of broader peace negotiations. So hopefully the PKK won't be returning to fighting against Turkey. And I think that's an important signal, not just for the Iraqi Kurds, who have almost grudgingly welcomed the PKK, but for the United States, who's looking at the situation on the ground and trying to figure out how to be most successful in the fight against these Islamic forces.
What would you make of the tactics of the Peshmerga and the PKK in dealing with ISIS? Would they be able to fight on their own, or is it just because U.S. air cover is assisting them that they're able to make these advances and successfully remove the ISIS forces from the Mosul Dam?
U.S. air cover and support is obviously critical to this. The Kurds don't have their own air force. Neither the PKK nor the Iraqi Kurds are really equipped militarily to fight against a group that has captured highly advanced U.S. weapons over the past few months, if not over the past year. So U.S. support has been critical, and I think that that's something that needs to continue if we're going to see the Iraqi Kurdish Peshmerga and the PKK forces continue their advances against ISIS.
We're talking with Aliza Marcus, author of Blood and Belief, the PKK and the Kurdish Fight for Independence. In your view, does the White House have its act together regarding the various factions here in Kurdistan? There are huge business interests in Erbil that the U.S. is inclined to ally itself with and protect, but the designation of the PKK as a terrorist organization suggests that the U.S. policy is at odds.
I think the White House has been really slow to develop what I would call a Kurdistan policy. So right now the U.S. is sort of operating as if it were 10 years ago, back when the PKK was fighting Turkey, back when Turkey was really our defense against, or even 20 years ago, a defense against the Soviet Union. Right now Turkey, as I said before, has a tentative ceasefire with the PKK. Turkey has talked with Kurdish fighters allied with the PKK in Syria. Turkey keeps saying that it's going to start some sort of formal negotiations with the PKK. So I think the U.S. really isn't thinking logically about the situation. I'm not saying the U.S. needs to take the PKK off the foreign terrorist list tomorrow, but they need to think on the ground, what is the PKK doing? What is it providing? And the fact that it's allied with the Iraqi Kurds right now is a really strong signal that the PKK can't be ignored.
Finally, do you think the Kurdish success against ISIS in Iraq suggests that there might be some success of Kurdish forces in dealing with the chaos in Syria?
Definitely. Kurdish forces in Syria have already shown that they're able to hold off ISIS, but it's been very difficult for them, and they've lost a lot of fighters. The U.S., again, there has refused to deal directly with the Syrian Kurdish group called the PYD. Their argument is the PYD is allied with the PKK. But again, we come to this sort of the circle where Turkey has spoken with the PYD. They've invited the PYD leader to Turkey twice last year. So why is the U.S. ignoring the PYD in Syria? It's very hard to understand that logic when the PYD has been fighting ISIS and has been able to hold territory against them.
You have contacts and friends in the Kurdish community, both in the war zone and around the world. What are people saying to you? Is there an excitement about this moment? Is there fear about what may happen in the next few weeks?
There's both excitement and fear, I would say. They're very excited to see that for the first time, really, Kurdish forces are coming together and they're taking a national stand and they're working together to protect their land. At the same time, they're very worried that if ISIS is successful, Kurds will be massacred like we saw what's been happening with the Yazidis. And at the same time, they're simply worried that that the PKK will be abandoned at some point. And I think they're concerned, but they are looking towards more support, and they feel that it's necessary if they're going to put up a credible stand against ISIS.
Aliza Marcus is author of Blood and Belief, the PKK and the Kurdish Fight for Independence. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Where do we stand in the Ebola outbreak in West Africa? The numbers continue to rise, 1,200 dead, hundreds with active infections, and possibly hundreds of other carriers of the disease too scared to report their symptoms. At a news conference in Geneva over the weekend, Dr. Joanna Liu, president of Doctors Without Borders, called for more leadership from the World Health Organization in tackling this epidemic. She expects it will take at least 6 months. Dr. Liu joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Dr. Liu, what do you think is the principal problem in the response to the Ebola outbreak in West Africa right now?
Well, the principal problem is the fact that the epidemic is still moving really fast, and the response that we have right now in the field is not matching the magnitude of the crisis. So we need more capacity in the field to contain the epidemic.
Is Liberia overwhelmed at this point?
At this moment, Liberia is one of the very hot spots of the epidemic. What we know from what we can see right now is we're still in the upward slope of the number of cases. So they're still growing up every day. So it's very difficult how far and how much more cases we will have. Our data collection is not completely strengthened. We don't know, and all the cases are not disclosed. So it's very difficult. But what we know is we have two centers of case management of Ebola, and the two of them are overcapacitated by the number of patients. I think the other, as well, real concern that we have right now is the fact that the medical health infrastructure has collapsed completely. And right now, the general population who are seeking healthcare for basic ailment like having malaria and fever cannot have care. We are faced to see six pregnant women not being able to deliver over the last week and losing their child because they couldn't find a place.
In Sierra Leone, do you think the question of possible national quarantine is on the table yet?
Well, they have started to take some measure in terms of cordon sanitaire, quarantine of some region. And this is something that is a very difficult decision. And it's important that it's well accompanied by communication and explanation to the general population. This kind of measure will only work if there is acceptance and understanding of the communities.
Have you lost any health workers at Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders?
For the time being, you know, we've been lucky, and then we don't have any of our staff who's been infected. We are taking high measure of personal protection. But the thing is, this is why we need more staff and more capacity in the field, because there's not enough actors. And that was the reason why I made that huge, I would say, call last Friday to have more players in the ground, hands-on, to take care of patients, do contact tracing, do some community mobilization.
The reports of violence at healthcare centers where people have been released from quarantine and individuals have been sort of spread into the community. Do you expect spikes in outbreak to occur in some of these communities? And there have been reports of those kinds of incidents in Nigeria with, of course, a huge population.
Well, this happens when there is fear. And fear is normal when you have this kind of epidemic that is, I would say, really deadly. So what we need to do at this point is to inform the population and make them understand what is Ebola, what are the risks, what needs to be done to avoid to contract the disease. And so this is why, again, any measure that is in terms of quarantine will only work if we have an informed population about what is the disease.
Do you expect some of the violent incidents to result in spread of the disease in Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Nigeria?
It's very difficult to say, and I cannot comment on this. But the reality is we need to work upstream of that problem.
Why the 6 months to control it? Is that some sort of incubation period? Is that some sort of mortality time frame?
That's really interesting, because I think people have got hung up on that 6 months. But what I was trying to say is, in the past, our experience with Ebola is the fact that it's an, I would say, epidemic used to behave in terms of weeks, because they were happening in isolated remote villages, and the chain of transmission will stop very quickly over 6 to 8 weeks. What is going on right now is we have people infected in urban area. If we take, for example, Monrovia with 1.3 million people, we don't know how well will be the chain of transmission in a highly dense area. So we are basically navigating in the unknown. So this is why it's paramount today that mobilization of the community, understanding of the disease, contact tracing, following and informing people about what's going on is key to solve the problem.
Big pharmaceutical companies in Europe and the United States have so far been resistant to develop powerful antibiotics and hold them in reserve for eventualities like this, developing vaccines for Ebola, even dealing with waterborne diseases that kill, you know, hundreds of millions of people each year just because poor people can't pay for these medicines. What's your assessment of our ability to deal with something like this if there's no financial incentive for companies to do the research necessary to develop proper treatments?
Well, the thing is, this is a battle that we've been leading for a while, MSF, with our access campaign. We have done that since the late 90s with ARVs, where we said we need research and development on neglected disease. So This needs to be, I would say, there needs to be some political will behind and some conscientization of what's going on. This will not happen overnight, but this is a battle that we're still leading.
Are you hopeful, Dr. Liu?
I'm always hopeful. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing.
Dr. Joanne Liu is president of Doctors Without Borders. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
End of the hour here, let's think about men of a certain age who love to make huge dramas out of stuff that maybe doesn't really matter. Things like working out a lot, note for note Aerosmith guitar solos, golf clubs, fantasy football leagues.
Well, if you don't, she might just happen to be at my apartment and see a video post of Ellie's mother swearing like a truck driver, and I might encourage her to hold a special parent-teacher conference on Sunday morning.
I did the final tweaks to my lineup on Sunday morning.
Oh, I forgot about that. We should probably make the deal then, shouldn't we?
God, you're an
It is decided.
You are...
It is decided. It is decided.
You are no gentleman.
And neither are you.
In the man-child world of entertaining pointlessness, actor Mark Duplass is a kind of superhero. His hit TV show The League, which airs on FX, is all about a group of 30-something guys obsessed with their fantasy football league to the point where it just takes over their lives. The show has taken over Duplass's life. He plays alongside his wife, Katie Asselton, who stars as Jenny in the show. But then Duplass is a self-confessed workaholic, with coaches to keep his marriage on the rails, therapy to keep him from flaming out, and when he wasn't satisfied with his kid's school, he paid to hire more teachers' assistants. Who can say no to Mark Duplass? Calling him a control freak doesn't come close. His latest project is a relationship comedy called The One I Love. Duplass and Elizabeth Moss play a couple who take the advice of their therapist to go on a rejuvenating weekend getaway.
That was a little bit of a weird fight last night.
I know.
I don't really understand what happened, but I feel like maybe we just talk it up to like some bad pot alcohol combo, put it behind us and not let it ruin the trip.
Agreed. Totally.
Cool.
What happens after that is uncool, uncomfortable, and very funny. Mark Duplass was very candid about his life and work when I talked with him, how his relationship with actress Katie Azleton has so far survived Hollywood and Duplass's oddball childhood.
There's this thing about me, which is that I personally grew up when I was like 15 because I grew up in New Orleans and it's a very accelerated path there. Mm. By the time you're 10, you're drinking. By the time you're 12, you're smoking pot. But by the time you're 15, you're kind of done with that and ready to start your career. And so I think that what happened is I was always very driven professionally. My brother and I were. And so there's this other side of me, this sort of latent child that gets to play and do whatever it wants on the creative side of things.
What do you bring from that sort of upbringing to this latest movie?
I'll just say that, you know, when we started making The One I Love, it was a very specific process in that I made it the way I made my early independent films, which was I want to make a movie quickly. I want to make it cheaply. I want to make it with a small group of people. I want this to be like an arts and crafts project in a camp-like environment. So I literally assembled like my 25 favorite people, cast and crew members, to do this. And when we started talking about what this movie should be, something kept coming up, which is that we're all in long-term relationships and all struggling with the sustainability of them. And we all kept laughing about how when you start a relationship, you sort of exposit the best version of yourself to them. You talk a lot about how you like to go to museums instead of like admitting that you've just been like streaming Game of Thrones on HBO Go. And you talk about all the classical music you want to listen to and go see. And then about a few months into the relationship, you let them know kind of who you really are. And that is such a strange thing that we do, attract people with a false sense of us, then reveal our true selves to disappointment. And we sort of took that seed and we built it into The One I Love. And it was a really interesting way to sort of engineer a movie from an essential concept.
Do you think that girls are attracted to people who go to museums and classical music? I mean,
here,
that cell line, does that work?
There's a couple of levels here. I think that men think that girls are attracted to that. Okay, so we put that forward, right? I think girls think that they want that too, to a certain degree. And this, by the way, crosses gender lines. This is not just a male-female thing. Everybody's playing that game for like a month with this strange smile on your face as you're looking at each other. And my wife and I work together and we talk about this all the time. And the more and more we think about, you know, God, we've been together for 13 years. What makes this work? Is it our shared sense of what life is about? Is it the fact that we do the same job and understand each other? And really what it comes down to for us is like, I think right off the bat, we liked the way each other smelled. That was big.
That was big.
And then everything after that is work and therapy.
So smell, classical music, museums, and then therapy.
Yeah, and then therapy. That's really it.
So we can't really give anything away, but the device in mm-hmm. this movie, this new movie, what does it do to allow you to explore a relationship in a different kind of way?
Yeah, The One I Love is a really interesting film because the central core of it is an examination of that perfect version of ourselves that we exposit to people. And then once people realize who you really are, you know, the guy who says he never farts in bed and the guy who really does fart in bed. And how do those two interact with each other is endlessly fascinating to me. And even after, you know, 13 years of being with my wife, I still screw up. I still find myself at times kind of trying to be this better version of myself in front of her and afraid to let her know who I really am or what I really think about something. And what is that all about?
So can you go seamlessly from this is the last museum exhibit I went to and I farted in bed?
Yeah. You know, ideally you want to be farting at the museum. I mean, I think in an ideal world.
Which museum is better for that?
The Guggenheim is great because, as they say, heat rises. Mm. And that lovely space there really just kind of shoots right up.
It's so touching. Do you have couples peers in L.A. in mm-hmm. the entertainment business? And do you share stories? Do you have common skill sets that keep you together?
You know, there's something amazing happened. We ended up at Jenna Rollins' house a few months ago having dinner with her. John Cassavetes is my hero. I mean, it's what I wanted for my career. I wanted to be an actor and make money as an actor to fund my independent films with my friends. And I have been able to exact that to a certain degree.
Films about really healthy relationships.
Yeah, about really healthy relationships. Exactly. And she was so fascinating to talk to because, you know, John was kind of a maniac, and I'm a little bit of a maniac and a workaholic. And at the end of the day, as similar as our career paths have been, the relationships themselves are totally different. And so you sit there talking and you think, oh, we're the same. We're going to commiserate together. And then you realize, nope, we're all – once we close that bedroom door, our problems are our own and we're all alone and there's really – there's really nobody to help. It's just you and that spouse. And that to me is why I keep making movies about this stuff. It is endlessly fascinating to me.
So why is your relationship not a casualty of the business like so many people talk about?
Tons of therapy. That's huge. Mm-hmm. I think that a modicum of self-awareness is very helpful to keep these relationships going. I think that also, you know, Katie and I live on the east side of LA. We have two kids. We're pretty boring. We're not like tabloid people. So there's less people trying to chop our legs off and trying to harm us and take us down, like in terms of the press and whatnot. I'm firmly ensconced in a little corner of the sandbox making my independent films. And people in the industry has chosen to lift us up rather than chop us down. And I'm very fortunate in that way.
Mark Duplass stars in the new movie, The One I Love. It opens in theaters this weekend. And for your fantasy football lovers out there, Mark Duplass will share some of his fantasy football tips next week on the program. Catch up on that conversation. Listen back to anything on the program. Check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With three updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging and an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.